The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, listeners. This is Joanna LaForgia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Southern Living. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2026 issue of Southern Living magazine. Today we're going to hear from the Grumpy Gardener, a regular feature in the magazine. And then we'll move on to a delectable sounding recipe, short one, for melted butter onions. How bad can that be? And then if we've got time, we'll take an imaginary stroll through Covington, Louisiana, in the long weekends section of the South super section of this magazine. And if we don't get to it today, we'll get to it in our next episode. Okay? Hope that sounds as good to you as it does to me. And now we'll start with our grumpy gardener, Steve Bender. The Grumpy Gardener always begins with a cartoon that takes about a third of the page. At least this one does. This one's all in pastel colors, light, soft colors. And it's a double panel. It has two pictures. In the first one, there is a woman. She's a middle-aged or elderly woman. She's got white, curly, short, cropped hair. This is a cartoon. These are caricatures. And she's got on lavender slacks and a rose red color sandals, and she has on a sleeveless tank top, but we don't see too much of it because she's holding a newspaper before her, or magazine before her. She's sitting on in her backyard on a lounge chair. She's got her feet up on a little square, a little rose pink square, a block of some sort. Beside her is a short table with a drink and some ice in it, and the glass is half full or half empty, depending on how you look at it. And if you're a mother, you just look at it as one more thing somebody left for you to clean up. Okay, back to our magazine listeners. She is in the background here. There is a fence. Oh, and there are a bunch of roses in a vase. Bunch of roses planted on her other side, on the other side of her. And there are two dogs sitting in the background. One is brown, against a brown fence. And one is brown, darker brown with a blue collar, and the other has a red collar, and he or she is white in the front and has a gray back, and the gray extends to the ears and the sides of the face. And the brown one is talking to the other one and saying, "Watch her face when I dig up that rose bush." And in the next picture, there is in the foreground an overturned, uprooted rose bush. And the woman I mentioned is running after them, yelling, "No!" And they are both running with their tongues out, mischievous looks on their faces. The caption, listeners, of this cartoon is, "Why Flowers and Dogs Can Never Be Friends." Guess that's a foreshadowing of what we'll see here. All right. The Grumpy Gardener by Steve Bender. "Dear Grumpy, how can I keep my dogs out of my flower beds?" Signed, Linda. That's simple. Don't let them in there. But somehow I think you want more from my answer. Okay, let's start by saying that, in my grumpy opinion, large or energetic dogs are incompatible with flower gardens. They don't see any intrinsic value in blooms, except for maybe snatching and eating butterflies off them. If accomplishing whatever goals are occupying their canine brains means stomping on or digging up your blossoms, they'll do just that. How to prevent this? Forget animal repellents. There is no smell on earth so gross that a dog won't tolerate it. To keep them out of the garden, you need a fence. Maybe you can regulate, excuse me, listeners, maybe you can relegate your pets to the backyard and place your plants in the front. Or install one of those electric fences in the ground around your flower beds. Next question, camellia confusion. My camellia's blossoms turn brown before they open and then fall off. What's wrong? Signed, Harriet. The problem is a fungus called camellia flower blight. A few blooms get it and fall to the ground under the plant. And then the fungus persists there. The next year, rainfall splashes fungal spores onto new flowers. And the cycle continues until the whole thing is infected. Fungicides, unfortunately, don't work well against this blight. The best control is removing any diseased blooms and throwing them out with the trash. Do the same to all fallen flowers, diseased or not. Then spread mulch around the camellia to cover up any remaining spores. Lost tomb moth. I'm asking this question on behalf of my dad. We live in USDA Zone 7. For the past 4 to 5 years, moss has been taking over his lawn and choking out the grass. These areas are in full sun. What's happening? Signed, Julie. Excuse me. Moss grows where grass won't. Usually the culprit is too much shade, because most mosses love shade and grass hates it. But some mosses like sun, too. In your dad's case, his lawn may be taking it on the chin due to compacted and poorly drained soil, mowing too low, and lack of fertilization, all of which aid moss and hurt grass. To fix these things, rent a core aerator this spring and run it over the lawn to reduce compaction. Fertilize the grass, which I imagine is bluegrass or fescue, given the zone, every spring and fall. That's fertilize the grass every spring and fall to thicken it. And don't mow the lawn less than 2 inches tall. Cutting too low stresses and thins the grass. Clay Aiken. I live in central Arkansas and have very poor clay soil that holds water. Every shrub I plant dies. I need something that will survive. Signed, Heather. Before you plant anything, you have to improve that dirt. The best way is to till in lots of organic matter, like chopped leaves, composted cow manure, and soil conditioner. These will coat the clay particles and loosen them, improve soil aeration and drainage, and make it easier for roots to grow. Another option is to build a raised bed atop the existing dirt and fill it with about 8 inches of good topsoil mixed with organic matter. And our last question, browning out. We planted more than 40 green giant arborvitaes along our property line in Brentwood, Tennessee. Almost all survived and have grown to 1 to 2 feet since then. However, they turned brown in early January, and now we're worried. Will our trees make it? Signed, Brittany. Fear not, my friends. You've already had some pretty good freezes this winter. Conifers often react to cold weather with off-color foliage. Grumpy is confident that this situation should resolve itself with the return of mild temperatures in the spring. And here is the footnote, which we always have, Grumpy's Gripe of the Month. And there's a tiny cartoon of Grumpy sitting on a chair outdoors and using an overturned red wheelbarrow as a desk. Got his typewriter, old-fashioned typewriter, on the desk, or the back of the wheelbarrow. Yellow paper is flowing out of it, and his hands are above the keys as though they are in motion typing. And he has brown trousers and a blue long-sleeved shirt, collared shirt. And he has light brown hair in this picture and a beard and mustache to match. Oversized nose in this caricature, and he has square glasses, like square-lensed glasses that are light blue, seem to match the shirt a bit. And then, of course, there's always our little yellow flower, happy yellow flower, that is standing beside him, and the flower's green leaves are arms. They act as arms. One is holding down the page in the typewriter, and the other is longer and is around the back of Grumpy's neck. And the flower is yellow and round with big orange lips smiling at Grumpy. And he is just grumped at it, grinning, grimacing at it. All right, here is Grumpy's gripe of the month. Whenever I grow tired of intelligent reporting, there's a particularly moronic home and garden website on my newsfeed that provides welcome relief. I won't mention it by name, but no story is too lame or ridiculous for that source to publish. For example, today I'm reading about dangerous potting soil that catches fire. This can happen, you see, because it contains flammable things like ground bark and coconut husks. Thus, quote, consider keeping plants with potting soil mixes away from any fire sources in your yard, including candles, smokers, and fire pits. And, unquote, and never use a container that has potting soil in it as an ashtray. Good stuff, geniuses, but you left out something. Never plant red-hot poker, burning bush, smoke tree, or pipe vine in hazardous dirt. You heard it here first. Okay, Grumpy. And we've got a nice, Grumpy kind of miles out here for a nice little footnote about a tree or a plant. And this month, it's a nuttail oak, and there's a drawing of it. It's a lush green, a mix of moss green and lime green and forest green, all mixed together, and the brown tree trunk, of course, and it's standing on a little bit of a patch of green here. Nuttall oak. It's worth giving this fast-growing tree plenty of room. Need a nice shade tree? This one is a grumpy fave, and now is a great time for planting. It's strong, wooded, long-lived, and majestic. Three good descriptors for oaks. But if I had to pick just one for my yard, our native nuttall oak, and the Latin name is Quercus texana, would be my choice. It grows quickly, isn't fussy about soil, and has no serious pests. You'll appreciate its straight trunk, pyramidal shape, and dark green leaves that turn bright orange and red in autumn. Numerous species of butterflies and moths use its leaves as a larval food source. Planted in USDA zone 6 to 9. The mature height is around 70 feet. Do deer eat it, you may ask? Not when it's that tall. Signed, Steve Bender. And that's our Grumpy Gardener for this month. And now, listeners, in the in-season section of the magazine, under the subheading Bounty, it says, why this Texas onion is a cut above the Vidalia. A cut above the Vidalia, why the Texas version is bigger and sweeter. And listeners, this is a one-page piece, includes a short recipe, and it has a photograph. There's a photograph covering almost half the page of some delectable appearing onions, slices of onions of this dish. It's golden brown, light color, and it's garnished, I believe, with, it's garnished, I believe, with parsley. I'm trying to see if it's, I don't see it here yet in the recipe, but there are huge round ones, and they're sitting in a white casserole plate, and it looks like they're caramelized. That's the word I was looking for. They're caramelized, and they look caramel-colored as well. Bleeding off to the edge of the photo are two glasses halfway filled with a lime green drink of some sort with some ice in it. And there's even a slice of lime in each that seems to be sinking to the bottom there. Yeah. All right. A cut above the Vidalia. Why the Texas version is bigger and sweeter. The Vidalia may be the South's most popular allium, but it isn't the original. In 1898, the first sweet onions made their way from Bermuda to Texas and were planted near the small town of Cotulla, southwest of San Antonio. By 1920, the state was a major producer of the vegetable and later funded agricultural programs that created the Grano 502, the parent of many sweet varieties, including the Vidalia. That's right, Georgia. You can thank the Lone Star State for your favorite onion. Fast forward to 1985, when after years of research, Leonard Pike, a horticulture professor at Texas A&M University, launched the 1015, an extra-large version with a low sulfur content that makes you less likely to tear up when chopping. This variety also rectified issues of inconsistency and disease, making it a boon for farmers. By 1997, the 1015 was so beloved, it became the official state vegetable. The name stems from the ideal day for planting the sweet onion, October 15th. But March kicks off its limited harvest season that ends in early July. Now's the time to get these spring treasures and use them in our melting onions recipe, a side dish designed for the 1015's large rings and natural sweetness, which leads to beautiful caramelization, in parens, says here. And here, listeners, is the recipe. Melting onions. The active time is 15 minutes, and the total time is 1 hour, and it serves four. Here are the ingredients. 3 tablespoons unsalted butter, melted. 1 teaspoon of Crayole seasoning, 1/2 teaspoon of garlic powder, 1/2 teaspoon of smoked paprika, 1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt, 1/4 teaspoon of black pepper, 12 ounces each, according to this list, sweet onions, 3 large 12-ounce sweet onions, peeled and cut into 3/4 inch thick rounds. 3/4 cup of chicken stock. 1 tablespoon of Worcestershire sauce. And 1 1/2 teaspoons of jarred chicken stock base. And fresh thyme leaves. All right, listeners, that's what it's garnished with here, thyme leaves. And we just take 2 steps. Step 1, preheat your oven to 450 degrees Fahrenheit. Whisk together butter, Crayole seasoning, garlic powder, paprika, salt, and pepper in a small bowl. Arrange onions in a single layer on a rimmed baking sheet and brush with butter mixture. whisk to roast until lightly browned on both sides. About 30 minutes, flipping and brushing with drippings halfway through. Stir together stock, Worcestershire and chicken stock base in a small bowl. Flip onions, pour stock mixture around onions on pan. Roast at 450 degrees Fahrenheit until onions are very soft, about 15 minutes more. Transfer onions to a platter, drizzle with drippings, garnish with thyme. And listeners, you may know, or may not, that you can refer back to any of these recipes because this broadcast will become a podcast later, and you can find it on our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. All right, are we ready to go to Covington, Louisiana? This article is in the Long Weekend section of the South, and it says, Covington, Louisiana is growing fast and staying grounded thanks to a close-knit community of makers and doers. And it starts, listeners, with a full-page photo of a, looks like, yes, a restaurant that we are looking at here. In the foreground, we've got some bushes and scrubby bushes around and some trees around. And, oh, there's a little bit of hanging moss in the background. And this is a two, maybe even three, but we can see two stories, two floors of this restaurant. And it's all open. It's got a porch from the left to the right side. One side of it ends on the top floor with a peaked roof, and it's all wood, seems to be all wooden with some metal roofing. And on the left side, it comes out into kind of an octagon, the porch does. And there are old-fashioned barrels, or old-looking barrels around that are used, I suppose, as tables. And there are wooden chairs and tables and a few guests seated there. Looks very shady in there. And the caption is, Waterfront Dining. Have your meal with a view at the Chimes Restaurant, located along the Bogue-Balaya River. Down by the rivers, at the heart of Louisiana's North Shore, Covington is growing fast and staying grounded thanks to a close-knit community of makers and doers. And this article is by Samaya Dorsey. Long weekend. It was a cloudy morning in Covington, Louisiana, a rare break from the sunshine. I'm used to seeing the town dressed in that sunshine. The streets still held the past night's rain, and the air was quiet. But all of that changed as I started up the stairs at Bogue-Balaya Fitness and heard the familiar beat of a Meghan Trainor song pulsing through the gym. I followed that sound to a mirrored studio where an 8:30 a.m. Zumba class was already underway. Dozens of residents moved in near perfect sync, sporting everything from light-up sneakers to shimmery gold headbands. In the center of it all was Mark Johnson, known to locals as Mayor Mark, looking perfectly at home in his gym shorts and ball cap. The playlist hopped from Latin pop to Zydeco, and it wasn't long before I was in the mix too, trying to keep up in my business casual flats. I had never felt so joyfully offbeat. And that's when I realized this town is more than just friendly. It's a place where people fold you in with no hesitation. where the mayor dances beside you and nobody minds a bit if you miss a step. I thought I knew Covington. I grew up just across the Causeway Bridge, and for years I'd drive an hour just to spend the day strolling under the oaks and walking along the river at Bogfalaya Wayside Park. I've always known how beautiful a city is. But it was only then, years later, and a little out of breath from all the dancing, that I finally understood how it moves. Founded in 1813 at the junction of three rivers, Covington was once the heartbeat of regional commerce. Rail lines and schooners transported cotton, lumber, bricks, and tar across Lake Pontchartrain to meet the growing demands of New Orleans. All the while, this North Shore locale was coming into its own. Warehouses, storefronts, and ox lots formed the foundation for what is now the historic downtown district. Its walkable patchwork of galleries, boutiques, and restaurants tells the tale of a city rapidly on the rise. I caught glimpses of this evolution from the passenger seat of Johnson's golf cart as we rode through town. "There's a story on every corner," he said, and he meant it. He motioned to a teal-blue cottage on West 23rd Avenue. The girl who lived there? She was the homecoming queen of Covington High School in 1957, he said. That girl was Peggy Caserta, the fashion pioneer behind bell-bottom jeans. We then crossed into the West 30s, a historically black neighborhood. He pointed out the old Rosenwald School, which was built during segregation, and the gym next door, where a teenage Aretha Franklin once sang. And, listeners, you probably hear that it's time to close today's episode of Southern Living. We hope you enjoyed listening, and we hope you'll join us next time. I'm Joanna LaForger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Southern Living is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you, listeners, for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. So long till next time.